Welcome to season two of Blazing Trails. This Salesforce podcast is back for another season of stories we've collected from our events around the globe. I'm Marissa Kranis, Social and Content Marketing Lead for Salesforce Strategic Events. We're sharing stories that reach beyond the tech industry. So no matter your career, location, or interests, we aim to curate a podcast that speaks to you. You will hear from inspirational speakers and conversations around game-changing innovations. Learn about a breadth of topics from AI to the fourth industrial revolution to the fight for equal pay and so much more. Artificial intelligence has been a topic of fascination for decades. From automated cars to machines that can intelligently and competently compete with humans in a game of chess, AI is innovating faster than ever. It's thrilling to look at all these new updates coming from AI. What's even more fascinating and thrilling is the history of this brilliant technology. How did AI originate? What are the milestones in advancement that have led us to robots and more? AI is now a mainstream topic, reaching a broader business audience. Every executive who wants their company to be a leader in their industry is focused on AI. Learning about the multidimensional history of AI is not only fascinating, but crucial to success in being industry leaders. In this Dream Talk from Dreamforce 17, Robin Bordoli, CEO of Crowdflower, sheds more light on AI, including dissecting five common myths. Take a listen.
So let's start by going back in time to 1956, 61 years ago. 61 years ago, four trailblazers, John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, Nathaniel Rochester, and Claude Shannon, convened at Dartmouth College for an 8-week summer workshop. And it was there that John McCarthy first coined the phrase artificial intelligence. It was an ambitious working group. What were their goals? In their own words, an attempt will be made to find how to make machines use language, form abstractions and concepts, solve kinds of problems now reserved for humans, and improve themselves. We think that a significant advance can be made in one or more of these problems if a carefully selected group of scientists work on it together for a summer. That's my emphasis. So, like most trailblazers, they probably didn't realize how hard it was, the path that they were starting on. So how did they do? Well, over the next four decades, there were a number of important advances that were made within the research world, but the real-world applications were few and far between. And in many regards, it was a winter wasteland for commercial applications. But then let's come forward in time to 1997, when we had the first astonishing milestone and breakthrough in AI. Gary Kasparov was beaten 3.5 games to 2.5 games by IBM's Deep Blue. This was the first computer program that defeated a world chess champion in a match under tournament conditions. Now let's fast forward another 19 years to just 1 year ago, 2016. This time, the game was the Asian board game Go. And this time, Lee Sedol, who was an 18-time world champion, was defeated by AlphaGo, which was a computer program run by Google's DeepMind. And this was the first time a world champion at Go was defeated by a computer program in a match under tournament conditions. We have a computer program that is better than every single human on the planet at a complex game. And then we have these failures, where they unintentionally kill themselves, and what is a seemingly straightforward task, they fail at. How do we reconcile these two? Where is AI truly in the real world? And the answer to this lies in the real world. Our world is messy and complex and a little confusing. So to do that, for AI to operate in our messy human world, we've actually got to explode five common myths about AI to make progress in this. So myth number one, AI is a magical algorithm. Now this myth is perpetuated by Hollywood. If you look at Her an ex machina. You see examples of computer programs or robots effortlessly mastering their environment. That's a myth. The truth, and here is the one and only equation I'm going to use today, is a little different. So this is the equation. This is the one equation to remember from today. AI equals TD plus ML plus HITL. So the truth is that AI is not about a magical algorithm. It's about training data, machine learning, and human in the loop together. All right, myth number two. AI is only for the technology elite. If you see all the mainstream media coverage, they're talking about Apple and Microsoft and IBM and Amazon and Facebook, Salesforce, Tesla, Google, and Uber. They're positioning this as technology titans on the field of play, bashing each other's brains out. That's not the case. AI is for every business. It's for every one of you and everyone here at Dreamforce. So myth number three, AI is only for billion-dollar new problems. You know, the media coverage is around autonomous vehicles. It's a very emotional, interesting topic. You've probably all seen them this morning around the streets of San Francisco. Or it's about drone delivery, taking drones from the military world into the commercial world. But the truth is that AI is also for million-dollar existing problems, things that might seem mundane or a little boring, but have tremendous business impact. So an example of that is categorizing support tickets. So no doubt a number of you in the audience, Salesforce Service Cloud customers, and you're dealing with a torrent of online feedback. Your customers increasingly are giving you feedback through email, through chat, through social channels. And that feedback typically will be in the form of an unstructured text-based conversation. So the question is, if you were to apply AI to that problem, how would you go about doing it? So you would start with the training data. So you would start with tens of thousands of support tickets or text-based conversations. And you might start with defining, first I want to define what the topic is, and I want to define the level of importance. If I can apply AI to that problem rather than humans, I can actually respond faster and more effectively and serve my customers better. So, myth number four, algorithms are more important than data. Again, the media coverage talks about this magical, mystical algorithms. We're going to flip a switch and AI is going to magically work. Well, within the industry, we've known for a decade or so that actually data is as important, if not more important, than the algorithms. This paper, written back in 2009, so Alon Halevi, Peter Norvig, and Fernando Pereira, to summarize it in layman's terms, they said, if you had a choice between making better algorithms or getting more data, get more data. That AI is about machines replacing humans. This is probably the most pernicious because it's the one that drives our collective fear and sense of anxiety and identity. So when these major milestones happened, they're emotionally heavy events. They get cast as machine defeats man. Now, that's an incorrect framing. The right way to think about this is not a single machine defeats a single human. The right way to think about this is a single machine plus thousands of humans that played the game of Go or game of chess and that machine learnt from, defeated a single human. So if you frame it that way, it feels like an unfair fight and in some regards, not an unexpected outcome. So this is why we should think about the combination, not the replacement. I'll give an illustration of why that is. Machines and humans are different. We have different relative strengths and weaknesses. Machines have fantastic computational power. Humans, our strength is understanding context, understanding meaning, operating in this messy human world, in this ambiguous environment. So most machines would pass that problem on the left, finding the eigenvectors. Most humans would fail at that. Most machines would fail at the problem on the right, finding the leopard print dress, because they don't understand the enter. They might just look for the leopard. They might just look for a dress. They might look for a print dress. They might look for a leopard print. So machines would struggle with that, understanding the context and the meaning. So this is why AI is about the combination. humans create the training data and provide the human in the loop to gracefully handle the fail states when the machines fail. And the machine handles the vast amount of data and to be able to objectively understand the confidence around a particular output as well. So it's the combination of these. So the way to think about business processes is not machines replacing humans, but augmenting. So if you think about a business process over time, it may start as 100% human, categorizing support tickets, you know, having conversations with customers. Those will be 100% human, and you might start to automate some percentage of it. But over time, as that human in the loop becomes new training data and improves the model, the percentage that the machine can handle will increase. But as a result, the volume of the work you can put through the business process will also increase. So we will continue to get this combination.
Artificial intelligence represents a considerable opportunity for business and society to drive productivity, innovation, and growth. For its promise to be fully realized, society must trust the institutions introducing AI into their lives. In turn, there is a responsibility to implement AI in a way that promotes privacy, transparency, accountability, and limits biases. This ensures the technology has a positive impact on all levels of society. In this panel from Dreamforce 17, moderators Vika Krager, Head of Technology Policy and Partnerships at the World Economic Forum, has a conversation with Paul Doherty, Chief Technology and Innovation Officer at Accenture, Liesl Yearsley, CEO of Atkin.com, and Tara Lyons, Executive Director of the Partnership on AI. Let's listen in.
And government is certainly not known for being forward-leaning on technology. And my experience was as our senior advisor for technology and innovation at the US State Department, I was constantly surprised at how little the senior decision makers, the folks who are really supposed to be guiding our country and protecting our citizens, how little they thought about emerging technology. And you know, we had the US Treasury Secretary a few months ago made a pretty bold statement that that AI is not on their radar screen as something that the effects will only be felt 50 years from now down the road. And that's not anomalous. It's an attitude that I encountered both across the US government but with my foreign counterparts overseas. There was a sense that technology is something that's far off in the distance. It's still the stuff of science fiction. But I think that for folks who are in the audience who really deal with these emerging technologies on a daily basis, and the folks here on the panel, we're here to discuss, is that true? Is AI really that far off into the future, other emerging technologies? Is it something that folks who are part of the Salesforce community and beyond, is AI something that we should be thinking about now? Or is it something that its promise is really off into the future? And so would love to start that conversation here today. Paul, maybe I'll start the conversation with you. I know that Accenture recently released a report around the promise of AI, that it's going to boost productivity and has the potential, I think it was up to 38% increase in profits over the next 10 or 15 years or so based on how AI is going to make our workplaces more efficient. Now, a lot of people think that that AI is just hype, and you know, we've got things like Siri and Alexa and some of these more tangible manifestations, but is it really going to transform our economy? How revolutionary is this going to be? Is this just hype, or is there real trends to back this up?
Yeah, well, like anything, there's clearly a lot of hype around AI right now. It's one of the most talked about technologies, but we believe that there's tremendous substance behind the hype as well, and we strongly would disagree with the Treasury Secretary's statement, and we believe that the impacts of AI are being felt today and will be felt very strongly over the next few years. And one thing we talk about a lot is that in our business, we've been at emerging technologies and how they impact business and society for many years, and we've never seen a technology that's moved as fast as AI has to impact business and society as we've seen with artificial intelligence. So we believe this is by far the fastest moving of any technology we've ever tracked in terms of its impact. And we're just getting started. So one of the questions we set out to answer that you referred to is there's a lot of talk and discussion about AI, but there wasn't a lot of sizing research to look at what the impact really was. So we did some research with Frontier Economics to look at the macroeconomic impact, and we did identified what you said, which is a 38% potential improvement in productivity that we were looking at. So it's the worker productivity that we could drive. And moreover, when we looked at it, we saw the opportunity to create something along the lines of $15 to $20 trillion of increased economic output in the 12 largest economies around the world that we looked at. So it's a very positive story. And one of the interesting things, though, was that we believe you have to look at AI differently in terms of the way you look at it from that perspective. Because AI's, typically when you look at these studies, you look at labor and capital. What can you do with labor efficiency and capital efficiency? And AI, we believe, is a fundamentally different way of looking at both, because AI allows labor, which you typically can't scale, to scale much more dramatically as you augment people with more powerful capabilities. And on the other hand, AI helps capital, rather than depreciate and decrease in effectiveness over time, actually increase the effectiveness of capital as well. So we started describing AI as a new factor of production and a new way to look at economic output because of the unique way that it multiplies both labor and capital and increases that productivity and output.
So we're going to be seeing completely new ways of creating workforces, of creating workplaces, how AI is going to be augmenting our laborers and people's ability to be more productive. So that means that for companies need to start thinking about, well, what does the future workplace look like? How do we prepare our workers for this new AI future? But even how do we prepare our consumers and our communities for AI? So Liesl, I know that you've actually led a successful startup that actually created AI tools. You've worked with IBM Watson on a lot of their technologies. How can companies start thinking about this landscape that Paul was just sketching out for us? How can companies get prepared for that kind of landscape?
Yeah, so just a little bit of context. The last company I built, Cognia, was actually acquired by IBM Watson. And at the time we were acquired, we were doing about 60 million interactions. We had 26,000 developers. We had at least half a dozen Fortune 100 companies using this. So this was not an insignificant volume experience that I have. I think it's, in one way we cannot by any measure prepare for what is coming. When we talk about the 50-year horizon, most scientists there are talking about singularity. And I have an opinion about that. We think of singularity as when machines get smarter than us and then start getting better. Well, if you think about it, the only condition for singularity is that a machine self-improves and we don't stop it. There's nothing that I see happening in AI today that says we're going to stop the advance of technology. And in that world, what is our role? So again, 50-year horizon, there's a lot more we need to think about right now. But 50-year horizon, if you think about it, if you see a little ant walking along there, you might go, put it outside. But if you see an ant, in this place in your house where you want to put in a bathroom, you're just going to blitz the nest. It's not like you're mean or cruel or anything. It's just kind of in the way of where you're going. So right now, what we need to be thinking about, I don't believe we can stop it, but we should be thinking about what are the values that these systems will hold. How will they make decisions? If their decision-making is better than ours, where does that come from? Do we want to give them human values, the same values which gave us slavery and right today, sexism and feminism and, racism, just an appalling set of values that we hold. In the near term, what companies need to be thinking about more is what, and government, is what do we do with displaced workforce? In Cognia, we started working on customer support. We were doing interactive AI, but we were also doing a lot of really intelligent predictive AI, and we were just moving up and up the skill chain. We were even doing prototypes where we were a university lecturer grading the papers of law students. So I don't think there is any profession that is going to be immune from the impact of AI. So we need to be thinking more about how do humans have meaning in a world where we're working half of what we used to work. What have we done with our current glut of time? We have reality TV and all of the knock-on effects of that. I'm not going to name names.
So, Tara, I know that before you were with the Partnership for AI, you were at the White House and actually helped draft a lot of our government's policies around AI. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, oftentimes, you know, the pace of change in the fourth industrial revolution is unprecedented, just how fast these technologies are developing and growing, as Liesl was saying. And so oftentimes government struggles to keep up. So what is the role of government? You know, there are all sorts of both positive impacts of these technologies that hopefully government can be accelerating, but also some potential negative consequences that government has the responsibility to mitigate. How can governments keep up in this space? What do you think is the appropriate role of government in shaping the trajectory of AI?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. What you said in your introduction with regard to government catching up really resonated with me personally, given my own experiences embedding myself in the environment of the executive office of the president. And certainly, I think also something else you said, which I would like to amplify, is that governments have a role to protect their citizens, and that is a particularly complex and challenging landscape when they actually don't understand sort of current state of the art in technology and what implications that state has for institutions that government has traditionally run that are meant to protect citizens with regard to civil liberties or justice in healthcare or otherwise. So one of the things we did at the White House in the last administration, in the Obama administration, was start looking at some of these open questions with regard to how the policy apparatus needs to be interacting with AI, either from a regulatory perspective, which a lot of people think about as traditional policy, or otherwise, government as user, as you mentioned yourself. So we ran a series of workshops. We reached out to the public. We brought on a bunch of experts through a variety of different convenings, and we ultimately produced the reports that you just mentioned. And really what we found was that, you know, principally, the thing that I previously touched on is the problem that needs to be addressed, which is that government itself just needs a better handle on how technology systems interact with the citizenry. And secondarily, you know, there also needs to be much more crosstalk between industry, civil society, and the academic organizations working to actually advance these technologies and the government institutions that that are going to be representing them. And so, you know, a big part of what the Office of Science and Technology Policy did in the last administration was try to facilitate more of those interactions that were multidisciplinary and cross-sector in nature, such that government representatives and policymakers across the spectrum of government could have a better knowledge base on, you know, what these technologies actually implied for the state of policy. And practically that bore out in several ways. You know, we had several sort of talent-oriented fellowship programs that the Obama administration administered, including the U.S. Digital Service and other fellowship programs that actually brought technologists in from industry to participate in government. And most of those programs still persist, which is great. And it also involved designing regulatory systems, particularly with regard to the portfolio of work that I worked on related to self-driving vehicles and unmanned aircraft systems in the National Airspace System. It related to actually designing regulatory regimes that took into account the perspectives of technologists actually at the bleeding edge of creating these technologies. And I think that actually, it has made a huge difference in those internal conversations in government, and I hope that those practices continue to be developed out, because that's going to be very necessary.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Plevo. Plevo is a cloud API platform and a global carrier services provider. Learn more at plevo.com. Next time on Blazing Trails, we'll be looking into the future. Discover what's on the horizon for the workforce when it comes to jobs, data production, and more. Thank you again for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up with exclusive content from trailblazers around the world.